Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Danae, and you're not used to hearing my voice, but don't worry. You've got the right show. Today is a special mashup, sort of meeting of the mind, so to speak, of two great podcast hosts. We have Aaron Armet and Ian Whittington, who have come to the table to talk about the similarities of two incredible juggernaut world building, storytelling. We're going to talk about the high fantasy world of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and the complex sci-fi world of Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. It's going to be a lot of fun, especially when we get to what is sure to be my favorite part of the show, the chaos, character chaos round at the end of the show. Who's going to win, Saruman versus Moopsie? We'll figure that out later. We'll roll some dice. But first, before we get too ahead of everything, let's introduce ourselves, because we are airing today's show on two separate podcast feeds, so we don't all know each other. I know some of your listeners, Aaron, don't know me. So let's start with you, Aaron. Introduce yourself to everybody. Some know you, some don't.
Thank you. Yes, it's great to be here on the Captain's Pod. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this collaboration. We've done a few cross promotions before, so I think our listeners are somewhat familiar with the cross pods there, but this is our first collaboration together, and this is going to be fun. It's going to be a mashup. It's going to be crazy. And I like to tell my listeners, like, thank you for wandering Middle Earth with me. And today we're going to take Middle Earth out into the cosmos, and we're going to compare and contrast Middle Earth and the whole entire universe, and see what we can get out of that. So welcome to Lord of the Rings and Captain's Pod, our collaboration episode.
Woo! Not much ground to cover there at all. Just the entirety of Lord of the Rings and the entire galaxy.
Just all history, all time and space. Yes.
Yeah. We're not doing it all. We're just going to do like a little snippet.
Yeah.
Ian, why don't you introduce yourself to the Lord of the Rings listeners?
Well, hello. I'm Ian, and I'm regularly hosting Captain's Pod with Danae. So, Captain's Pod listeners, you'll obviously know us. Lore of the Rings listeners, hello. We host a show about Star Trek where we go in no particular order across the 800 some adventures and across movies and TV shows of the world of Star Trek. And yeah, we kind of take it an episode at a time. Our regular day jobs are writers for the YouTube channel Cinema Sins, so we kind of give each episode the Cinema Sins treatment as well, and do a little bit of light-hearted sinning and nitpicking as we go. But yeah, we are passionately in love with Star Trek, and Danae is a passionate fan of Lord of the Rings. So
I am.
It seemed like the perfect crossover for us, really, didn't it?
It is. I'm really excited about today's episode. So I'm Danae, and thanks for tuning in to this very interesting episode. We're going to be airing it in two different ways. You can listen to the Captain's Pod edit on the Captain's Pod feed, and you can listen to the Lore of the Rings edit in the Lore of the Rings feed. Mm. So, from what I understand, Lord of the Rings is more of a, you know, you're going to unload the car and put the groceries away. You just want a quick hit of Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Ian and I's podcast is more of a, you're going to drive to work, hear the first half, drive home, hear the second half, and then maybe on a lunch break, you can listen to the outtakes. So it's a little bit longer.
Dream about it at night.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we're going to do some unique stuff today, and I'm really excited because I get to kind of sit between the both of you, and I love passionate storytelling. So Gene and J.R.R., they're like two, obviously, like I said, they're like the juggernauts in a way of creating content, and you two are really passionate as well. Even before the show started, just listening to you guys talk about the randomness, calendars and all these different things. And it's just really fun. I get to sort of sit in between the both of you today, essentially, and chat about Lord of the Rings. And I'm really excited to do that. So we're going to talk about some world building similarities, some theme similarities, and then we're going to play Character Chaos. And so make sure that we have fun with that. Oh, I got to get my dice for that. Okay. So while you guys
needed.
Yeah, you guys start chatting about the world building, because it's such an intricate part of both worlds, sci-fi, high fantasy. There's so much to cover, and they're coming from the imagination of these incredible storytellers. And so I would love to hear how you guys are going to chat about the start of these two spaces, not to say that space is better, like more like
two worlds, two space.
And don't be offended. I'm gonna grab my dice while you do this.
Yeah,
and this absolutely. Is not a competition.
It's not a competition, but Lord of the Rings is better, and you know, we've got all. Just kidding. I'm just kidding.
We'll see how that my edit goes for that.
Yeah, exactly. That's gonna be edited out. Okay, so I want to take you back over 100 years ago to the trenches of World War One in 1917. There's a very young soldier in those trenches. He's not there for very long in the Battle of Somme in France. And while he has a little bit of downtime, he starts writing down some of the stories that had been percolating in his head for over 10 years, even at that point, even as a young man. This young man gets sent back to England as he had trench fever, which was a common sickness there in World War One. And as he's recovering, he continues to jot down these stories that have been bouncing around his head for so long. Fast forward about 20 years, this young man has gone to school. He's started to grow a family. He's gotten married. He's got some kids. He's a professor at Oxford. He's worked on like the Oxford English Dictionary, so he really knows his language really well.
Quite an important book.
Very, like, you know, yeah, just a little dictionary, you know, in the history of the English language. Yeah, exactly. Oh, and by the way, I should say, I feel a little bit intimidated talking about J.R.R. Tolkien to a Briton as an American. I'm sort of like, yeah, let's go across the pond and let me tell you about your greatest literary contribution.
Do. There's nothing all, more, you know, there's
Shakespeare,
nothing more British.
Charles Dickens, they're great, but J.R.R. Tolkien.
He really is the one. There is nothing more British than telling somebody else about their culture. That's a very English thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. So fast forward a few years, and this young man, he's grading papers, and he's grading papers, and he turns over this exam book. There's a blank page, and out of nowhere, he writes this line: "In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit." And then he sits there, and he thinks, "What in the world is a hobbit?" Right?
That's
he doesn't
amazing.
Know what a hobbit is, and so he's like, "I figured I probably should continue figuring out what a hobbit is." And so he's just kind of starts writing and starts writing and starts writing. And then you get this whole story of the Hobbit. Obviously, it wasn't all in one sitting. But Tolkien, this sort of shows Tolkien's writing style is for decades and decades and decades, he builds up this base of knowledge, languages, ancient myths, ancient cultures. He's got all of these stories bouncing around in his head. And then all of a sudden, in one burst of inspiration, he spits out this little thing. And then he's like, I need to explore that further. And then he continues to do that. And his whole writing style is not, I'm going to have this perfect strategic outline plan of my novel and I'm going to write it out in a perfect story. It's very fly by the seat of your pants. And The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, all of these books are very much exemplary of how Tolkien approached his work. And he had a point later on in his life where he was able to look back reflectively and sort of articulate some of the motivations that he had. And his first and primary motivation, and this might surprise a lot of people, was he had these languages in his brain. He would invent languages in his brain. It became so natural to him. He said it was like breathing for him just to create languages. And at one point he realized, you know what? Language is not disconnected from life and the experience of living and being a human. Languages are connected with culture. They're connected with history. They're connected with stories and with myth. I probably need to write a story to go along with my languages, right? Yes. Yep. And in fact, one of his very good friends, C.S. Lewis, kind of started to convince him of this point, saying, hey, Tolkien, you need to like write down some of these stories to go along with your languages. And Tolkien was like, yeah, okay, I probably will. So if it were not for C.S. Lewis and Chronicles of Narnia, we never would have gotten Lord of the Rings. And there's so many other things in the fantasy sci-fi world that I think we probably wouldn't have gotten if Tolkien kind of hadn't made the genre what it is. I think he's sort of the grandfather in some ways. So he's wanting to write a story for his languages. He has a passion for myth, for ancient myths, particularly Northern European, but he also feels like there's something missing. There's a distinctly English myth that he feels is missing from the world of literature, from the world of stories. And he, you know, you might think, well, you've got King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. That's very, you know, British. And mm-hmm. sure it is, but that's also intricately connected with, you know, the Christian tradition and some of those mm-hmm. beliefs and that belief system. And Tolkien wanted to go even further back, like the creation of the world further right. back. Right. And so he starts to create these legends that he felt were decidedly English, right? And that were not connected with the Christian tradition, but were about England itself, this origination myth for the land of England. And I'm going to read this quote. It's a little bit long, but these are the words of Tolkien as he's kind of looking back and reflecting on his work a little bit. He says, "It," meaning the legendarium that he wanted to create, "it should possess the tone and quality that I desired, somewhat cool and clear, while possessing, if I could achieve it, the fair, elusive beauty that some call Celtic. It should be high, purged of the gross, and fit for the more adult mind of a land long now steeped in poetry."
Ugh.
So you can see there, yeah, his aim is he wants to create a beautiful legend, a beautiful myth that the English people could really grab onto and say, this is our story of a people.
I prefer this fantasy
it's so bold, isn't it? It's so bold to say history is missing this. Yes. I'm going to give it. And what's bolder than that is that he did it.
He did
like,
it.
He pulled he it off.
He did.
Just yeah. unbelievable. Just incredible.
So when you look at how when Tolkien writes about his own writing and his own works, you get this weird dance between I'm so bold as I'm going to create history, but also this humility of I don't know if I can do this, right? If yeah. I could achieve it sort of a thing. And he's like, I'm going to make this whole cohesive legendarium, but I'm going to leave pieces for other hands and minds to sort of fill in some of those holes, right? And so he was like so bold in terms of, yeah, I'm going to create a whole history for the world, but also humility in terms of, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if anybody's going to read this. I think he even called his works absurd at one point. Like, this is all just absurd. People are just going to laugh at this.
They're talking think I'm trees. Young. Come on.
You know? Yeah. But you have this weird interplay of boldness and humility that comes when Tolkien starts to reflect on his own works and his world.
Oh, I love so that glimpse into the person behind it. And I'm excited to hear Ian talk about like Roddenberry's like approach and kind of the world building for Star Trek too. Cause obviously there's differences and there's similarities in the Star Trek world. A lot of it is like more visual film entertainment, and you have a lot of writers kind of adding to the structure, whereas Tolkien really created like the foundation for other people to play with later in a way. I remember the first time I read Lord of the Rings, it was one of the most fulfilling imaginative experiences of my life. It's something that like you just kind of don't forget the first time you read certain books. And I had never read some of the words before. I mean, you need a dictionary
mm-hmm.
when you're going in. And then you learn these words that do this very specific thing, and they're just perfect. So I love that the Oxford, I mean, that makes sense. He's just a dictionary.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I had never read anything where we spend like what seems like 17 pages describing a hill, you know? And I remember thinking this hill is going to be so important later. It never was. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't good the hill. Point. The point was that there's this, everything comes alive. And I know not everyone has a vivid imagination. I have a very vivid imagination. So when I read a book, it's a different experience than people I've talked to who don't see things in their imagination. Yeah. And so reading Lord of the Rings for them was like they appreciated the world building aspect because it gave them some concrete things to think about rather than like, I'll imagine Tom or whatever. And then it's described and it gives me extra details, but I've already got him in my imagination like pretty quickly. Yeah. I think what was really interesting too about seeing that come to life on the screen later on, I'm talking about Jackson's, you know, work specifically. I was so thrilled because again, all that detail and all that love and that care, which he might have just been doing for himself to fill that gap, but he ended up doing it for us all, like you said, for, you know, it had a greater purpose kind of in that, and to be spurred on by friends. I guess if it was just for him, he would have never written it, I suppose. But I loved seeing that it came to life in such a clear way. Like the first time I saw Lothlorien, I was like, there it is, you know.
Yes.
These beautiful places and these beautiful things. And we're going to talk a bit about themes here in a second, because the themes of the story are important. But that foundational world building, it's so powerful when you have someone passionate. And I love that you talked about it being coming almost from languages first, just this brilliant person that had something up in the mind that seemed kooky that he brought to life. And I'm sure Roddenberry felt the same way.
Yeah. Before we get to Roddenberry, I want to touch on one other thing, Danae, and you were sort of dancing around this, but Tolkien coined a term that he called sub-creation. And it was sort of this idea of the world that we're living in is the primary creation. And an artist or a storyteller, they create a world that is a sub-creation within this primary world. But even deeper than that, like when you are reading a text, you are imagining in your mind what this world is, right? And so for Tolkien, that was like the highest form of art and enchantment was, I am going to create in your mind a world. You're basing it off of my words, but it's based off of all of your own experience. Like if I say hill or a loaf of bread for a reader, they're going to imagine all the loaves of bread that they've ever had in their life. And they're going to, that archetypical piece of bread is going to be in their mind, or that archetypical hill. Right. And so that for Tolkien, that was why literature was sort of the highest form of art above, you know, plays or poetry or some of those other things, because it could, you had this essence of sub-creation that would create a world within the mind of whoever was consuming that story.
Oh, it's so good.
Because the visual mediums are doing so much of that work.
Yes, they
you,
do.
Aren't they?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they do. And that's why some people have complained about Peter Jackson's movies. They were like, I just wish people would read the books without watching the movies, because then they think, you know, Aragorn looks like this or Gandalf looks like that. And I'm like, well, okay. You know, I see your point.
They do.
I see your point. Yeah, mm-hmm. Somebody they do. But, you know, to me, it's like, if we can get more people into Tolkien's works and they go movies to books, I'm totally fine with that. I'm not a big stickler for that.
And some people it works better because they don't know how to visualize. So they go in seeing Galadriel and now they don't have to imagine it. They're just like, they've got her and they're just reading the extra details and they can enjoy the different parts of the story that they've never maybe seen come to life, because there's a lot that didn't get there. So
that absolutely is.
Ian, as you're listening to Aaron kind of chat, like, are you seeing so many similarities? Like, what are some of the things you're thinking of?
It's mind-blowing to think about how similar Gene's idea for Star Trek was and what drove him, how similar that is to Tolkien, but looking forward instead of the history. So Tolkien wanted to recreate this myth of England, and Gene wanted to do the same but for the future, and to create this history of the future, of not just what humanity could be, but what he genuinely thinks we will become. Like, he was so confident that this is the path that humanity will take, because we're inherently good, and we, of course, we're capable of terrible things, but eventually, once we can get past a certain things like poverty, war, prejudice, things like that, that's where our future will be. And much like Tolkien, it was all in his head. And we've been lucky enough to like interview writers that have worked with him, and they've all kind of said, we just wanted to pick the things out of his head. So Gene didn't really write everything that was in his head down, and I wonder if he had like a C.S. Lewis that he would have written some more of it down, but his medium was always television and sci-fi, and just get it out there onto television. And he's much kind of like a businessman in that respect as well, in that he knows that his work won't be seen if it doesn't have popular appeal and he can't get a studio on board. I mean, the advantage of books is that maybe nobody will read them, but you can just kind of like get it all down and it's kind of there for all of history. TV is trickier because you've got to get somebody to green light it and put it out there. But yeah, he absolutely had all of this in his head, this society of the future, how these different alien races are going to interact, what will humanity's legacy be? And everything would kind of have to go through him in terms of like what made it onto the screen. So he had it all in his head. He had it all there. And to him, it was like, from what I've heard, it was all kind of obvious, because somebody would ask a question and they'd be like, well, no, obviously it's this, this, and this. I was like, yes, Gene, it's obvious for you because it's in your head. You made it, you're loony. But he's like, this is what it should be. But at the same time, he wanted to cultivate that through the best science fiction writers that were available. So with the original series, it has so many writers and so much creative input in it, because he had this vision for the future, but didn't want it to just be what was in his mind. Like, the beauty of him is that he would welcome all of these different writers to expand this universe. And to say that it's expanded is an understatement. It's still going 50, 60 years later with new writers. And it's just wild to think that Gene passed away in 1994. And there's been like more Star Trek after Gene than there has been before Gene. And that just blows my mind. But there's so many similarities between him and Tolkien in that respect.
I really think that's powerful. Really, it's just like storytelling becomes so important. I think some people realize that through storytelling, you're giving other people a chance to not only step out of their life and their circumstances, but also reflect on who they are. Like, we all see ourselves in different characters in different moments. And in the world of Tolkien, we have so many different characters on different character paths, and they have a beginning and an end. Whereas in Roddenberry's world, there are some characters that they do have a beginning and an end, but then because of the filmmaking, we can kind of tweak stuff and we can go back and we can do a different timeline. And all of a sudden we're seeing these reiterations of characters because we want to see more of this specific character. And then all of a sudden we're seeing young this character and old this character. So it's a bit different in that way, but we're still always reflecting on the ones that we're kind of relating to in different ways. One of the things about similar about both of them too, then the world building that I've loved, just quickly before we go on to the theme similarities that between these two
legendariums.
Yeah.
I use that in Lord of the Rings a lot.
Legendarium. Yeah. Legendarium. Sounds like an aquarium filled with legends. is that the characters, the world building characters, we always seem to have very similar archetypal themes. And I really love that there's this uniqueness to them all. There's the young person that's overlooked, or the short person, like the little hobbit type person that you can see a lot of, like the childlike characters in. You've got really strong females in both of them, different races. There are aliens in Lord of the Rings. Talk about, like, where does Gandalf come from? That's some fun stuff to look into.
Yes.
So there's a real expanse of Tolkien kind of going outside of just what you see and like where we're coming from in the depths. And in Star Trek, we also explore that stuff too, but we have a lot more visual stuff to sink our teeth into, so to speak, where we have different alien creatures and ships and exploration. And I feel like on the Star Trek side of things, I don't know if you're going to agree with me here, Ian, but the themes that are explored are really, really rich, because you're meeting these different races every episode. And so it's almost like in Star Trek, the theme is almost the main drive of what you're looking at, because every episode there's something that you're kind of like exploring in each specific one. It is part of the world building technically, but because it's more episodic, the theme is really pushed forward.
We're not done yet. If you like this episode, please leave a review and share with your friends. And remember to subscribe if you haven't already. We'll be right back.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.
Yeah, one of the really comforting things for me about Lord of the Rings is the existence of the Silmarillion and this kind of index and code book for the history of this world that you can interpret, but you can't really argue with it. It's there and it exists.
I know, Star like Trek... when I first read it and I read what happened with Armin, I was heartbroken. I was like, no, Armin, no. This is such a tragic story. I wish I would have never gone to the Silmarillion for that reason. I'll just say that. No. Go on, Ian. I'm sorry.
It'll make you cry.
It's horrible.
Star Trek does not have that codex. It is informed by the body of work. So a good comparison for the politics nerds out there, both of you, America has this constitution that's written, it's encased in law, and that's the Lord of the Rings Silmarillion. In England, we don't have a constitution. It's based on a whole number of different works of literature and case law, and that's Star Trek. It's just this, the present becomes the history, and it's I love it because it gives it so much flexibility to be new, but it can also hold it back because there's a lot of people that end up saying, well, that's not what Gene wanted and that's not what Gene intended, because there's nothing to refer back to. He had it in his head and he had these certain really hard and fast guidelines, but no strict rules, and so many of them are being held up now. So what you said, Danae, about the episodes being really thematic and less about world building and more about tackling a theme is completely true. Star Trek is an incredible vessel for tackling any kind of theme you want, political, religious, sociological, economic. All of it is great. It prioritizes the themes over the world building, for sure, because that's the thing that Star Trek wants to explore, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, which makes sense, you know, given, I think, what you said about Gene earlier. Just, if it's all in your head and you just want it to be good TV, and he's exploring humanity, he's exploring what the future is for humans, believing that in the future we will have accomplished more than just curing the cold or whatever, that we're actually figuring out how to have, you know, really deep, meaningful conversations with each other and other alien races, and kind of having come to a general sense of peace. Like, that's a huge theme to explore. So you can see him kind of pushing that forward. But there's probably, I mean, the themes that I can think about for Lord of the Rings are, there's so many.
There's so many. And it's not like Tolkien has sat down and wrote and was like, okay, here's the theme of friendship, and now I'm going to write an episode about friendship, and we're going to have Data there. Is Data actually capable of having a friend in, you know, Geordi LaForge or something like that? Like, you know, but the themes are there, but they're not so on the surface.
Yeah. Right?
They're a little bit more built into the story. They're more implied than they are explicit. And I think part of that was because Tolkien really loved myth and fairy story, or what we would call fantasy. He loved that medium for teaching moral truths and, you know, tackling some of these themes and these moral questions of morality. But he didn't like allegory, right? Which he felt was too didactic and too like on the nose and too explicit. He really wanted to build his themes into something more story-based, more character-based, where we could draw those themes out, but not necessarily read it and be like, oh, the moral of the story is don't yeah. tell lies or whatever it is, you know?
Man, that's such a tough yeah.
Never cross a Balrog bridge yeah. without yep. your sword and your
Let
staff.
Sleeping Balrogs lie.
Yes, yep. that's exactly it.
Because Star Trek is all allegory. Like, it is very, some of them are very thinly veiled. Oh, this is definitely a Vietnam War episode. That's what that's summing up. So it's so interesting that Tolkien wanted to do the same thing, but almost handcuffed himself a bit by not wanting to do strictly allegory.
I don't know. My biggest theme that I pulled away when I read Lord of the Rings, and we talked about this when we were chatting about this show, is the very end of the third book where Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin return back home. And in the books, they return home and the war had been brought back home. And, you know, you think about what Tolkien had seen. And also, I mean, similar with Roddenberry, you've got like war themes that are in both just kind of touching on the complexities of war and everything like this. But it was really jarring when I got to that particular part, because I thought that everything was over, you know, when we were in Mordor. Honestly, I was ready for it to be done. And I was like, okay, we're good to do the heroes come back home. They're a little bit taller. This is exciting. And instead, it had been taken over. And these bad guys were still there, ones I hadn't thought about for quite some time. They're still there. And they've been poisoning the people and with their words. And I was a little bit exhausted reading it. Like, no, not what else. But, you know, you've only got so many pages left and you're wondering what's going to happen. And it turns out that for me, what I pulled from that was the power of like letting consequences like almost come to their own, that there's consequences for different actions. Because in the books, you know, Wormtongue is the one who kills Saruman himself after having kind of just been done with it. Now, that happens in the movies too, but it's way, way, way earlier. And so you miss that part where Frodo stays his hand and Frodo didn't kill Gollum so many times. There's all these times when he himself would not take the life of someone else or take things so far there's no return and instead take on hardship himself as a character. And so to do that and see that because he did not kill Wormtongue or because Aragorn didn't kill Wormtongue, that Wormtongue went all the way back and ruined something for other people, and feeling the weight of that, like, I'm glad that he let that stuff build, because what ends up happening is Wormtongue takes care of the problem and Wormtongue takes care of himself. And sometimes no action, even though there's hardships for that decision, lead to a resolution on their own. I don't know how you do that in Star Trek. How do you do that in an episode of Star Trek?
I could argue... Man, I can't think of a specific episode that comes up, but there's plenty of examples where evil kind of undoes itself. That's definitely the good versus evil theme is very, very heavy in Star Trek. But I'm interested to hear Aaron's thoughts. I'm not stalling at all.
So there's that theme of good versus evil, and I think we're also kind of dancing around the sort of implied metaphor versus overt allegory, you know, kind of Tolkien versus Roddenberry approach to things. And I think part of this comes back to when Tolkien, he wrote down a couple of rules of what makes a really good story. And one of them was this idea of enchantment, right? So when you're reading a work of fiction, there's some level of you that knows that it's not true, right? And so you have to suspend your disbelief. And just believe that this story is real. But there's another level of engaging with the story in which you are just simply enchanted by that story and that world, and it completely takes you in, and it feels real to you. And not only does it feel real to you, but it starts to evoke emotions inside of you. Like the best thing that I can compare this to is if you've listened to some really great works of, you know, classic symphonies and things like that nature, where the music really moves you. Like, that's kind of the feeling that Tolkien is talking about when you get enchanted by a story. And I think that's why he kind of landed more on this side of implied metaphor, because I think that lends itself more to that enchantment sort of a thing, rather than sort of the explicit allegory, which is, yes, we're going to have a court of law on is Data human or not, and we're gonna have these moral arguments back and forth, which is clear allegory, right, of some of those questions and themes that Star Trek picks up, and that's great, and those are really interesting, and those are the fun episodes, and they're the ones that, you know, at least I remember. Mm-hmm. And that's great, but they're a little bit more overt in terms of what the writers, what message they're trying to get to you, and not that that's bad, but I think it's a little bit misses the mark a little bit of that enchantment of a story and having that being really consumed.
That's a really, I love that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because there is, I mean, I do get enchanted watching Star Trek as well. There's a couple of episodes that have just, mm-hmm. they draw you in, but due to the differences of storytelling outlets, you know, and that's, they're never going to be able to be compared apples to apples. We have a show that needs to directly tell you what it's doing so that by the end you feel confident to come back again, because psychologically you want to have all of the bows tied up, and, you know, unless they're doing a two-parter or something like that, you know. But in Lord of the Rings, you have however long it takes you to read the book. It might take you a weekend, you know, but you're still like drawn into it. And when you can reference back to something like, have you ever had that moment where you're reading a book and you remember where you were when you read it? And so you're not just rereading a book, you're having a memory of where you were when you read it, mm-hmm. or when you saw it on television, like, oh man, the last time I saw this, I was over here. And like, there's, yeah. they find a way of almost like implanting in your mind, not just the enchantment part, but like it's your real life sort of overlaid with this enchantment. And I love that you brought that together. Like, it is difficult if you're casting a spell to do a quick one, you know, you got 30 minutes over here on this one and you've got like 3 months of reading over here.
Yeah.
It's a little bit exactly. different.
They are different mediums. Oh. Yeah, for sure. And I do remember, I mean, Star Trek, certainly it does get to that level of enchantment, right? And not so much like overt allegory. Like, you know, my latest encounters with Star Trek have been Strange New Worlds. And there's that one episode where all of a sudden they're in a musical. Right. Like, yes. I was totally thrilled by that episode. And I don't know if we want to give spoiler alerts or not, but the end of that episode on the final ensemble, and there's a group of people who start to sing that you would never, ever in the whole Star Trek or Lord of the Rings universes ever think that group of people would sing. And I was blown away because I was completely enchanted by that particular storyline. And it was only, you know, 40, 45 minutes, however long those episodes were, but completely enchanted by that.
Well, it's an interesting one because that breaks the format, which is what we're talking about. Star Trek is, by definition, confined by its TV movie length, popular appeal, and back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in particular, it had to stick to this one episode memory almost, because being in syndication, that's where it made its money. If it didn't make sense on a rerun, it wasn't going to get watched and there wasn't going to be a future for the show. All of the money that TOS made, large in part, was due to reruns throughout the 70s. So yeah, its hands are tied by that. And I think it gets better and better with time. So Deep Space Nine was the first one that really managed to, and maybe Gene Roddenberry would have been spinning in his grave, but managed to break that one episode memory, and you have this entire, basically, season-long arc of this war with an alien species. And it was kind of the opposite of what Gene wanted, because this was the humans and a dozen other races, basically in a world war, but on a galactic scale. And yeah, his dream was always, we're past that now. We don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
But I love it because that's kind of the more realistic, gritty, what I would actually expect space to be like. Sadly, if there's that many aliens out there, there's probably going to be some conflict and stuff. So you do get these overarching stories, and Deep Space Nine is the best example of it, of just these themes that run throughout, these characters that come backwards and forwards. There's plenty of worm tongues in there that are doing their shady dealings. There are villains, there are good guys that turn into villains that turn back into good guys. And that is where, that's probably like the best intersection of Star Trek and Lord of the Rings. I'd only just thought of this, that Deep Space Nine is a really good overlap between the two, because you have that extended, more long-form storytelling.
I would also say that we also are in this interesting era. You mentioned Strange New Worlds, Aaron, and in this series, we're again kind of like restarting something that we've already seen in a way. So it's before TOS, before the first one that came out. And so, you know, you've got like this little old school vibe to it, but you have new writers. And I think the most enchanted feeling I've had so far is watching, because I didn't watch all of TOS. I'm kind of experiencing Star Trek as an old fan, kind of, you know, rewatching things with Ian. And so I get to watch Ian get excited about certain things. And then if we have guests.
Which is every week.
Yeah, but there's a couple episodes that happen in Strange New Worlds with new writers going back and sort of paralleling TOS episodes with Strange New Worlds and showing these like little glimpses and hints of what would have influenced the TOS episodes and what happened in TOS that would influence these episodes, and really spending a lot of careful time crafting the story weaving in a way that as a new person, I'm going to miss all of it. And I do. But they're still delivering a great show for the person who's just watching like myself. But for someone like Ian, who knows all of these Easter eggs, there was one particular episode where it was like started with a wedding. What was that one?
Yeah, that was it's the last episode of season one. And it's basically doing a parallel with Balance of Terror. So they kind of, something happens with the timeline and they relive something.
They're reliving it. And the enchantment in that one for me is that the writers did such a great job of referencing the original series without messing with it, which has got to be tricky, reinventing it and giving it a new element. It's almost like expanding your field of vision, going, well, here's something else you were seeing that you didn't know is happening over here. And because of the medium, they get to keep playing in that universe. They get to keep playing by adding some details and just sort of expanding the vision of it. That was really, really fun.
That gives them the opportunity to mess it up, like that's perhaps true. In darkness. But it's a great opportunity.
You don't like two Spocks,
sure.
Ian? Two Spocks are great.
We're not going to talk about Into Darkness right now.
No, we're not. I think this is a great kind of landing spot to jump into our last segment for the show today. Unless there's like a couple of other things you guys wanted to touch on regarding the similarities between these two worlds and how they kind of, you know, have something for everyone, because not every Lord of the Rings high fantasy person is going to be drawn into the sci-fi world and vice versa. But there are a lot of things to be really respected about both mediums. So did you guys have anything else before we go into the character chaos?
Yeah, one of the similarities we mentioned earlier on, but I wanted to touch back on, and it's probably a controversial one, is that secular nature of it as well, and how Tolkien wanted this myth, like you said, that was separate from the church. And Roddenberry was so similar with that feeling as well, to the point where he gets accused of underrepresenting religions. So you don't see any kind of modern day religious iconography on the bridge of the Enterprise. There's no representation there, because in his mind there's no religion in the future. Like, okay, some alien species might have it, but humans have quote-unquote evolved beyond religion. And he saw that as a huge dividing factor across the world. Is that, do you know if that's how Tolkien felt as well, and that's why he wanted it to be more secular?
I really love that you brought up this question. This is a fantastic question. And those who are really deep in Lord of the Rings, like what Tolkien has said about Lord of the Rings, are probably squirming a little bit in their boots right now. Because while I did say, yes, Tolkien wanted to create a tradition that was separate or maybe older than the Christian tradition, at another point, he said that the Lord of the Rings is fundamentally a religious work. Fundamentally a religious work. Right?
I didn't know that. I didn't load that at all. That's so interesting.
And he said it was probably unconscious at first, but it was made more conscious when he would go back and revise and do the editing and all that, those things. But he also very said he did a very clear line of, he didn't put in any like explicit religious practices, right? Like there's not a lot of like ordinances or sacraments. there's not a lot of those, right? But again, it's this idea of implied versus explicit. Like if you read Lord of the Rings carefully with a view to something religious, you can see there are prayers, right? Frodo, when he falls down in the dark tunnels of Shelob, words are given to him, right? And he starts calling out, Ael Bereth Githoniel, right? He starts out this prayer calling out to one of the, might we say, gods that controls or the powers or the guardians of Middle Earth. He calls out to one of those for power and for light so that he can have light to light his way out of these dark tunnels and to get past Shelob, right? He didn't know those words before. They came to him from somewhere outside, and yet it was a prayer to something outside of him, something bigger than him, for light and for goodness in his time of need, right? So there are moments like that all
That's
throughout.
That's really interesting. Because my interpretation, and again, it's been a long time, of that moment was that that was the gift that Galadriel had given. And so when she's talking to, you know, how it sort of has the overlay, like she's speaking to them before they leave. I thought she gave him the words to light it up.
I don't know if she did or not. My impression was that.
That's really interesting.
I'll go back and look at that.
Exactly,
but
to your point.
What are the elves if not gods? Like, right? To the hobbits.
To the hobbits, perhaps.
To the hobbits, absolutely.
But that's to your point, Aaron, that there's a way to, because it's not heavy handed, it's not like, and then Frodo prayed. That there's a there's a way that you can interpret whatever happens.
Yeah. There is one place. There's a book called Unfinished Tales, which, as you can imagine, these were tales that were unfinished when Tolkien died. And his son Christopher went and kind of gathered all these notes and tried to publish this particular book. And in one of these passages, Tolkien is describing Numenor. Okay, so Numenor is the ancient kingdom of men during the Second Age of Middle Earth, of which Aragorn is sort of the descendant. 3,000 years later, right? And Numenor is in Amazon's Rings of Power as this great king of kingdom of men. Numenor had a religious practice where three times a year, the king would lead the people up to the top of this mountain, which was literally called the Holy Mountain. Eagles would come as representatives of God, and they would hold these very specific prayers and sacrifices to the one creator god of Middle Earth, Ilúvatar. Eru Ilúvatar is what Tolkien named him, right? Now, that was in an unfinished tale. It's in the notes. But that was, as far as I can tell, that's only like the overt religious practice that Tolkien actually wrote down. But you can start to see some of those themes interweave themselves of, yeah, this is religious. And I think Tolkien viewed his work as himself. I mean, he was devout Catholic, very devout Catholic. And he viewed his works as sort of a worship of his God, the creator who, you know, the creator of the world, and sort of his emulation and his adoration and his worship of his God by trying to create this other world, coming all the way back to that sort of boldness and humility dance that Tolkien does. Like, yes, God, I'm going to worship you with this work of literature that essentially rewrites the whole story of religion. But
just gonna take what you did and improve it a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple of gaps. That's so interesting. I had no idea. That's fascinating. It's interesting how two different viewpoints can spark off into these different worlds.
It really is. And to that note, we could probably do a podcast about this for the next 10 years.
Easily.
We're not announcing a new podcast. No. We're
not
just
yet.
We're going to shift over into
Lord of the Trek.
Yes.
Trek of the Rings. Star Ring. Stargate.
Star Ring has been done. That's been taken.
So here's our idea. We started talking about it. We started talking about all the different characters and how we could chat about them. And then we joked about them fighting each other, and it turned into what you're about to witness. Now, we've not tested this. We've never tried it before. So
may never try it again.
We'll just see what happens.
It's going to be awesome.
Aaron and Ian have prepared a list of 6 good guys and 6 bad guys in each universe. So we've got 6 good guy Lord of the Rings characters, 6 bad guy Lord of the Ring characters. So yeah, exactly. We're being general. 6 good guy Star Trek, 6 bad guy Star Trek. And I'm going to roll some dice, and then we're going to randomly put them together and just chat about maybe who would win a fight or who would make a better tea. We don't know. We're just going to figure this out as we go. It's chaos.
We're not done yet. If you like this episode, please leave a review and share with your friends. And remember to subscribe if you haven't already. We'll be right back.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over 1 million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.
So just to kick us off, let's actually hear the character names first. Let's start with the good guys. Aaron, who is your list of six good guys?
Yeah, this was really tough because there's a lot of heroes in Lord of the Rings, but I whittled it down to six, and that is Aragorn, who becomes King of Gondor. There's Gandalf, the wizard. Faramir, who is sort of an unlikely hero. Galadriel, because, I mean, she's just amazing. Samwise Gamgee, who I would argue is the true main character of Lord of the Rings. And to round out our list, Gimli, just because Gimli's awesome. And I think everybody is going to go for Legolas. So I'm a little contrarian there. I'm going to go for Gimli.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Okay, so those are the good guys.
Yes. On the villain side, we've got Sauron.
Of course.
Classic. Gotta have the Lord of the Rings. We've got Gollum, who arguably, is he a villain? Is he not? I think that's at the debate. Shelob, the giant spider monster. The Nazgul, which are those nine kings of men.
That's a whole set.
That's a whole set. I'm sort of treating him as one right now. Yeah. We've got Saruman, the betrayer of the wizards, and Smaug, the dragon.
Oh my god, this is exciting.
Again, I don't know if I'd argue he's a bad guy. He was just looking after his treasure.
All right, Ian, what's your list of good guys in Star Trek?
I love that Aaron said it was hard to narrow it down. How hard do you think it was for me to narrow it down? There are so many TV shows. So what I decided to do was to go easy on myself because I could have picked like fan favorites and whatnot. I decided to be representative and pick basically six captains from six different shows. So we have Captain Picard, captain of the Enterprise D in Star Trek The Next Generation. He's the bald one. Captain Janeway, the first female captain to have her own TV show, captain of Voyager from Star Trek Voyager.
And consistently underestimated, Captain Janeway.
Completely. Yeah. She is, I could go off on a whole rant about how pooped upon Voyager is, and unfairly so. Number three, I have Captain Sisko, the commander and then captain of Deep Space Nine from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Captain Archer, the first captain on screen of the Enterprise chronologically, Captain Archer of the Enterprise NX-01 from Star Trek Enterprise. And then Captain Pike of Strange New Worlds. So yeah, a selection of captains to choose from.
Now we have a lot of bad guys we can choose from too. And if Q is not on your list, I quit.
I mean, it's Q for all six spots because he can.
Because he's everything. Yeah.
It's actually six different Qs.
I'm going to guess Moopsie's in there too because Moopsie's Moopsie's not. Okay, well then let me
I
just
not
real
pick
quickly
Moopsie
say
this time.
Moopsie was a character in the animated Star Trek show, which is really fun. It's called Lower Decks. If you're trying to find a way to get into Star Trek and you like animation, it's a really fun start.
Yeah.
There's this adorable little fluffy creature called Moopsie that just like sucks the bones out of creatures. You would never see it coming. And then the joke on our show is anytime we have an episode now, since watching the Moopsie episode, it's who would win in a fight? Moopsie versus... And then our audience gives us some selection options. Often it's Moopsie that wins.
Moopsie would have been unfair. Moopsie would have just won whoever they went up against. So I decided to omit them from the list.
Moopsie versus Saruman? Or Sarun? I don't know, man. Sarun's just an eye at some points.
Yeah, but he's the tower Moopsie, I'm sure, could just eat that bone tower.
Yeah, but Sarun is more than just flesh and bones.
Yeah, guy. Yeah. Oh, but we know we're getting a glimpse into how this is going to go.
We are.
I think it's
going to
work. Okay. Sorry.
My villains. Number one, yes, Q. Q is my number one villain. It was actually quite tricky from here on out. I'm sure I will have missed some fan favorites, but we have number two, Kaan Noonien Singh, probably the ultimate first really iconic TNG villain TOS villain that wasn't the Klingons or the Romulans or a species. This was an individual. So yeah, that's Kaan. am the Borg Queen. Not just representing the Borg, the entirety of the collective. She's got an army at her back. Gul Dukat, who is the chief bad guy antagonist for Deep Space Nine and kind of a big instigating factor behind the war that went on there and kind of the epitome of fascism and being a general meanie. And he's a Cardassian. Representing the Romulans is Sela, who's actually a human that was adopted by Romulans. And she manages to encapsulate everything conniving and sneaky about the Romulans. And then this is my wild card. Tolian Soran, who is the main bad guy antagonist in Star Trek Generations. Not a much loved film other than by myself, but he is the same race as Guinan. So he is an Elorian. Oh, I was almost going to forget the name, which sounds very Lord of the Rings.
You could have said anything, and I would have been like, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Checks sure. out.
Honestly, not too, Aaron.
he's an Elorian who is extremely old and extremely intelligent. So that's my...
I'm excited about this. I would have... Because we just went through a monster series. We watched just like monster-themed episodes recently. I would have been throwing in some of those monsters. Like the tar monster...
The ink Armus, yeah, I almost did the Gorn, but he doesn't even have a name. He's not a bad guy. He was just plunked on a planet and told to beat up Kirk. He's not a bad
person. He just looks ugly too.
Impossible decisions across the board. So much you guys could have chosen. Well done. Good job. Okay. I have chosen the dice. I have a good Lord of the Rings, a bad Lord of the Rings. The good one is very, very like beautiful, flowery. The bad one looks like Sarun's eye, you know, it's like all red and dark. For Star Trek, the good one it has sparkles in it, you know, like some sort of nebulous. And the bad one is my metal dice, which these are very dangerous dice. I don't recommend gifting them to anyone if they have children. Round one. How many times are we going to do this? Three times each, right?
Yes, I think so.
All right, we're going to do three rounds. We'll do hero, villain, like we'll kind of go back and forth. Yeah. Does that sound good? All right. Great. So for Lord of the Rings, you're going to go number two. And for Star Trek, you're going number one.
All right. So for heroes number two, I've got Gandalf the Wizard.
This is perfect. And nobody will believe that this isn't staged. I have Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Picard
versus Gandalf, everyone.
This is fate.
I don't want to do this.
No, you can't do that.
That's, no. Oh, man.
Those are my two favorite characters. What's happening?
This is amazing. Danae, discuss.
This is amazing.
Well, first of all, anyone versus Gandalf is going down. But then at the same time, Picard, is this them fighting? I feel like it's them meeting. There's some kind of a miscommunication and they're going to fight, but then Picard is going to talk them out of it, right?
Right. Well, he's going to Shakespeare his way out of this.
Shakespeare it out, but I think an element of Gandalf is he's not just violent and powerful, but he also has great diplomacy to motivate people to action. Right, okay. Like that's sort of his nature. I'm gonna kindle whatever spark of hope there is. I'm gonna kindle that into a flame, and we're gonna do something awesome with that.
So this immediately, they meet. They're trying to figure each other out, and then immediately it turns into a 17-year long friendship.
Yes, where just like real life,
they're going into the archives. We're talking archaeological conversations. We're talking like. The tea, everything is they are best.
Would you like some Earl Grey hot? Sure. Maybe something a little stronger, perhaps. Yeah.
They would just love each other.
They're lost to time. It's, you know, like in the movies, it looks like Gandalf goes into the archives to find out if Frodo has the One Ring or not. It's going to take like a hot minute. But in the books, how many years is it?
It's in the books, it's 17 years.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
There's some back and forth. Wow. Yeah. You just named 17 right off the tip of your tongue. But that's exactly
I thought
right.
It was 17. Yeah. So what's going to happen is these two meet right when Gandalf is supposed to go do that. Picard joins them and they lose an additional 17 years.
Yes.
We lose the captain of the Enterprise. Riker has to carry on as captain. Yeah.
The great fight is getting them apart from each other. Because yeah, I think
that's the fight. That's how do we separate these two?
Let's,
literally, you can't. But there's a scene in The Return of the King at the very end of the book, close to the end, where Gandalf and Galadriel and Elrond are sort of sitting and they're watching the stars at night and they're having this great conversation, but it's all in their heads. It's all telepathic.
Mm.
I sort of feel like we could plop Captain Picard down there with them, and Elrond, Picard, Gandalf, Galadriel, they're all going to have this telepathic communication about history and culture and arts and the nature of the universe. And it's just going to be an amazing thing. And I would just love to sit and take notes and be like, let me just learn from these masters of.
Well, you can't because they're just sat in silence.
I don't know. That's the problem.
One of you say something. Yeah. And you can take notes.
Just one thing. Just say one thing wise.
No. You don't. Anyone who knows them, you don't ask anything because it will take so long to hear it. It's for those that are ready to learn. Like you have to be ready for Picard to speak. But I feel like Picard would be really seen as a person by Gandalf because Gandalf is okay spending time talking and listening.
Yes.
I feel like at a lot of the shows and stuff, you know, you're just like super speeding through parts and they're making fun of Picard for wanting to talk about his love of archaeology. Whereas Gandalf would be like, let me go show you this hill.
You're going to love this hill.
Let's I'm going to tell you all the history of this hill. And then Picard would be like, make it so.
Mm-hmm.
My genuine argument would be that Captain Picard has faced down against literal gods. He has always come out on top, one way or the other. Like he has faced down against Q, who is as powerful as Gandalf, probably more powerful. And yes, that could be because of Q's deference to Picard, but he's come out on top. He has been faced with immeasurably unbeatable odds as a lowly human and always come out victorious. And was ever going to go sideways, Q would just come in and snap him to safety because Q likes him. My argument will always be Q comes in and saves the day.
Yeah.
I think if there's a versus here, it's going to be like who out talks who, and maybe Picard would win.
Who out diplomacies who.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's flip over to the villains. For Lord of the Rings, you're going number 5, and for Star Trek, number 3.
All right, so number 5, I have Saruman, the other wizard.
This is amazing. For number 3, I have the Borg Queen. That's a great matchup. Both of them having armies of darkness.
Well, Saruman does have an army. Like, we could say that, right?
He does create a set of orcs, shall we say, that are superhuman, somewhat crossed with humans, and they can run in the sunlight. So these are war machine type of orcs, right? They don't what does he say in the movies? You do not know fear, you do not know pain.
If
that doesn't sound like a Borg, I don't know what is.
That one moment in the movie where he like pulls the guy, like he's been stabbed by that sphere, and he just pulls him closer. It's like he's got this crazy face. Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Man, it's hard because I think what it would come down to is they have this army of orcs and this army of drones. And the question would be, would the brute force attrition of the orcs overcome the Borg assimilating them in time? So would the orcs wipe out the Borg before they had time to be assimilated? Because once you reach that peak of the Borg assimilating the orcs, turning them into drones, doubling their forces, there's a point of no return where it's just not going to win. But if the orcs can just brutalize them before that happens, then Saruman and the orcs win. I want to see this movie. Yeah.
That would be great. And that is kind of one of the tried and true battle strategies of the orcs in Lord of the Rings is we are going to have overwhelming force.
Yes.
And your forces are going to be really tiny and ours are going to be really big. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's something to that, but you know, if the Borgs are shooting phasers at them, I'm going to cross a boundary here, but unless
crossed it when you said Borgs plural instead of Borg.
Oh, sorry. If the Borg are going to be shooting phasers at the orcs.
It's not phasers. They don't have phasers. They have disruptors. Whatever. And they have assimilation tubules.
Well, this is what I can say. If we give the orcs some lightsabers from Star Wars,
maybe
there's a chance.
I quit.
Maybe there's a chance. Yeah. Well, and we're forgetting Saruman. Saruman is a powerful wizard. It's not like it's just going to be Borg versus Orc. We're talking about Borg Queen is she's not like down in the battlefield. She's just, you know, up space chamber thinking things that they're all connected. Because in this, you know, these bad guys are just connected by thought. It's one hive mind. But you have individuals in a way. Yes, Saruman is individually like saying, okay, go and fight. But you've got, they're very powerful thinkers. They're making decisions for themselves.
Solving on the field, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're calling it out in the field. But Saruman is also in play. He's not just calling it from a tower. He has incredible power. Like he's been wickified. He's been manipulated. He looked in that palantir a little too long, perhaps. Yeah. But
he could use some of his, you know, angelic powers, shall we say, and do something there.
He could.
Yeah.
Because theoretically, he's just as strong as Gandalf. He's just right. Like they're the same race, right?
Even stronger, right? Yeah, they do come from that same, shall we say, class of spiritual beings that would roughly translate to archangels or angels to us humans. So he has some divine powers to him.
Just like Gandalf.
He could call upon. Yeah, just like Gandalf.
Yeah. And he's still in his white phase because at the time of him having the orcs, he hadn't been stripped of his powers yet. So
it's true. Yeah, he's still there.
Gandalf is gray. Saruman is like powerful. So, you know, you talk about like disrupting the forces. He might be able to like take his staff and do some sort of blast radius or something and knock some of their technical gear out of, you know.
Maybe he could use his palantir and sort of do some cyber hacking so that the queen can no longer give out orders to all the Borg, you know.
Just imagine if the queen gets a chance to assimilate a wizard, then it's just game over. Get the Borg with the wizard powers. That would be unstoppable.
What would his name be? Locutus?
Yes. there's got to be something clever that I can't think of. Nope, it's gone. But I think the argument against the Borg Queen winning is that humans
Oculus.
Yes, it would be Oculus. That's perfect.
That's perfect.
I think the argument would be that the Borg keep getting beat by stupid humans. Like Picard beats the Borg, Janeway beats the Borg. Some like a wizard with an army of orcs. Then the Borg have got the orbital bombardment. They have ships, so just raining down hellfire on Middle Earth. It's a tough one.
Yeah, but if we're gonna go for an all-out Middle Earth fight, then we're bringing in other people.
We're calling some dragons.
No, no one said that. No.
Hey, you brought in the ships.
I think we've exhausted this one a little bit.
Yeah, I think that we might come to a couple of these battles where we might have to ask you guys to give us your feedback after you've listened to the show and tell us what you think would happen.
I might give this one to Saruman.
I think it'd be Saruman. Yeah, I'm going to say it.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, let's go back over to the goods, shall we?
Should we mix it up a little bit and let's do like a Lord of the Rings hero versus a Star Trek bad guy?
Let's do that. So we've got Lord of the Rings hero number one for Lord of the Rings versus a Star Trek bad guy number five.
All right, so our hero is Aragorn, son of Arathorn, also called Elisar, and a lot of other names that I can't remember off the top of my head, but Aragorn.
Yeah, he's powerful. And who is the bad guy he is going against, Ian?
So the bad guy is Sela, which is going to need a little bit of explanation. So she is a human that was kidnapped by the Romulans and has risen through the ranks to be the head of the Romulan Secret Service. So she is part of an organization that does not exist on the books and does all kinds of shady dealings.
Sounds very Ranger, doesn't it?
It does. I like, I'm getting some spy vibes, like
definitely spycraft. Okay. There is an argument to be made that she is the most powerful figure in the Romulan power base because her organization kind of puppeteers some other things.
Interesting. You have on one side Aragorn, this character who is apart from his power, but then like he knows he has connections, and then you have her and she has connections too. So they meet and they both are like on their own. They don't have any like whole battles. Like, does she have an army? Because, I mean, Aragorn has armies at certain points, but...
She has an army.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, too, if Sela, if without her army, if she was isolated on her own,
yeah,
how would she be in, like, a hand-to-hand fight? I mean,
yeah,
against the longsword,
whatever.
Not good.
But we throw her in, a literal ring with Aragorn, a handful of gladiator-type weapons. How would she fare?
I mean, they're all trained in martial arts of some sort. Okay. There'd be Romulan martial arts. I think she'd be so sneaky that she would find a way to sneak a disruptor or a energy-based weapon of some sort onto her person, but it would be in like pieces. So it would take her a minute to assemble it, and that minute window would be Aragorn's best chance of taking
Aragorn runs up to her and cuts her head off with the sword.
Yeah, longsword. Yeah, I don't think hand-to-hand there's much competition. I was going to say, as a Romulan, she has super, super, super strength, but she's not. She's a human, so she doesn't even have the super strength. She's, I think she's half Romulan. So she may have a little bit of increased Vulcan Romulan strength.
What about like in terms of mental acuity? Like she sounds pretty sneaky, but Aragorn himself, I mean, Aragorn's going to look into the Palantir. He's got a lot of like mental ability that he can bring, a lot of psychological things that he could bring to the foreplay. If this were like, if they were to like sit down and play a game of chess,
Sela wins. I think Sela wins all day long because Romulans are, it's incredible that you pick chess. They're often described as the best chess players. Picard always says dealing with the Romulans is like playing chess. They are always
3D chess, no less.
Yeah. 3D chess, absolutely.
So
they're
here's the scene.
So many moves ahead.
They meet, they're in like a tavern. They just go solo. Okay. They end up sitting close together at the table.
It ends up being talking again, isn't it?
They're kind of close together. There's a chessboard. They see it. They make eye contact. They decide they're going to chess it. She wins, and she's sassy about it. Or how is she about it? Is she sassy? Is she antagonizing? Is she kind of like
smug? She is silently smug about her victory.
Okay, so let me bring this point because she sounds like a very arrogant sort of an individual.
Very arrogant.
Now, Aragorn's crucial moment is he knows how to use his enemy's hubris against them, right? Mm-hmm. Because he knows, okay, Frodo's got the ring. We're going to send Frodo out there. The whole armies of Mordor are between Frodo and Mount Doom. Therefore, I, Aragorn, I'm going to do the queen's sacrifice, right? Coming back to chess. I'm going to take my whole army and put it on Sauron's doorstep and see, I think he's arrogant enough that he'll take the bait and then we'll clear the path for Frodo. So do you think Aragorn might be able to use a little bit of Sela's pride against her a little bit?
I think he would have to because her driving force is to basically eradicate humans and to stop them from being the dominant power in the galaxy. Because
sounds like Sauron.
She resents
them. All right.
So it's a perfect matchup, but she is so confident in her even half Romulan superiority. It's basically, it's incredible that you've described it like this because the episode that takes her down, she tries to march her army right under Starfleet's nose. The ships are invisible and there's this detection grid that she thinks she can get through, but her overconfidence accidentally kind of like exposes one of her own ships. She has to pull back entirely and we never see her again. I think Aragorn, if Aragorn can capitalize on that arrogance, then he wins.
One of Aragorn's names is Elisar, which has its roots in the Elvish word for hope. And so Aragorn's whole theme is hope. Even when the odds are innumerably stacked against you, we will still have hope that light can prevail. So that's kind of Aragorn's thing.
It's a good matchup. And I feel like he might like be impressed with her a bit. But then since she's on the side of doom and destruction, they would have to part ways and maybe meet back for battle at a different point. Mm-hmm. They'd be an interesting pair to meet. We also have discovered that at no point can we put Lord of the Rings and Star Trek characters stripped of all abilities into an arena because Lord of the Rings will win because they have like hand-to-hand combat.
Star Trek is just
phasers. So we won't do that again. Data. All right, let's do another one of hero versus villain, shall we? So we'll do Lord of the Rings bad guy versus Star Trek good guy this time. You ready?
Yeah.
Number 3 for you, Aaron.
Okay.
And number 6 for you, Ian. Six good guys.
So who's our good guy?
Our good guy is Captain Pike of the USS Enterprise from Strange New Worlds. Pike Hare. Yes.
Who's he going against, Darren?
I know who
he's going up against. Shelob, the spider monster.
Right, how is Pike losing this? Come on. Pike is winning this all day long. He has the Enterprise.
He has the Enterprise. Pike. It's just Pike.
He has his charisma. He seduces the spider.
He's going to seduce the spider, who all she ever does is hunger for fresh meat. And she eats light. Like, her mother was ate light. Like, that's how she consumed, but she would eat light. And so that's who Shelob is. I think Pike, you know, he's going to try to cook her something. He's going to, like, try to charm her with that dazzling smile. And she'll be just like, sorry, babe, I'm going to wrap you up in some webs.
I think Pike's going down.
Blood.
Yeah.
No! Pike will talk his way out of this.
There is no way to talk to Shelob.
She doesn't talk. There's no language there. Well, I mean, I guess there's a little bit.
His specialty is first contact and dealing with creatures who he can't communicate with. He's built to do this.
You got a point there, but I don't know.
How does Frodo win against? How does she leave?
Galadriel's gift of light.
Okay,
Pike
seduces Galadriel, gets the gift. And
really, here's the point of how Shelob ultimately is defeated, is she defeats herself, really, by Sam holding up the sword Sting, and she puts down her soft
abdomen.
Like belly, abdomen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Onto the sword, and she essentially stings herself and goes into her hole and dies of her wounds, right?
Presumably.
He pulls off his little triangular pointy
his communicator.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Pulls it off and then just go, hello. Yeah, pulls it up at the last second.
The soft underside still is pretty thick. I mean, Sting was like all the way in there up to its hilt.
Yeah. He'll get a full arm in there. He'll sacrifice an arm. Have you seen what happens to Pike? He will sacrifice his body for this. This is how he ends up in the machine.
I think we're
also assuming that Pike has somehow ended up like in Shelob's lair. What if Shelob was actually ended up on the ship? Like, what happens in that scenario?
On the Enterprise.
Beamed into space immediately. Transported away.
Star Trek writers, right? She accidentally gets beamed.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden all the power goes down.
That's right.
Yep. Except for life support and gravity.
That's correct.
Never go out in Star Trek.
That's correct.
And then what does Pike do? He's the only one on the ship with Shelob.
Jeffrey's tubes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he'd go into the Jeffrey's tubes. It would be very sticky, you know.
But that's where she would go. She would want those tight, dark, narrow places where she could set her traps and put up her webs.
Wait, how big is she?
She's huge.
She's big, right?
She probably wouldn't fit in one, though.
She's not fitting in the Jeffrey's tubes.
He would have to go in the Jeffrey's tubes to get around, like a little rat in a hole. And she would have to, like, put up her lair maybe in, like, the shuttle bay or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want this episode of Strange New Worlds.
The warp core, because she's somehow... I don't think Shelob likes light, though.
Yeah, I'm getting a little conflated there with Ungoliant, the mother who kind of actually eats light. But Shelob just wants fresh meat.
She just wants fresh meat. Okay, so if she wants warm, then she probably would go to the warp core. It's probably a little bit warmer in there.
It's not
so
pumping out heat, it has a shield around it. It's not creating Blinky the fish.
Okay, so where is the warmest place on this ship?
The Jeffrey's tubes.
She can't fit!
Okay. I thought you were going to go is the Godzilla route, where she ends up in the warp core and turns like nuclear and just absorbs.
She becomes so huge.
Yeah. Okay.
Enterprise can't even contain her.
So then everyone dies.
So
Shelob gets huge and everyone dies. That's the answer.
Close up the ship. Yeah.
All right. That's amazing.
Either everyone dies or Pike is drained from blood in Shelob's lair.
Yeah.
I see those are the only
that one's not ending in a conversation over philosophy and diplomacy.
No.
That's beautiful.
Well, is that a good place to wrap up, or do you guys want to do another one?
Well, I mean, I think we managed to not decide any of them.
Yeah.
We're doing great.
Yeah.
No. We know Picard and Gandalf are BFFs. That's what we know. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah, Picard and Gandalf.
Life.
We had a couple, like, what would happen if they met moments. We had a battle, a couple battle moments.
Yeah.
I mean, we could Epic save song. More for later. Maybe we can do one of these in our own podcast. I don't know.
I love it.
Yeah, so if any of our listeners have feedback or they want more of this character chaos, then you know the channels, you know the emails, the social medias, hit us up and we can meet up and do some more of this.
Yeah,
I want to hear your debates. I want to hear your counterpoints to any of the points that we've made.
Yeah, what did we miss? What did we get wrong? Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, please. I love it when people point out what we did wrong.
Let's actually transition then to where people can find us. And what I would love to do, let's start with you, Aaron, is for the Captain's Pod listeners, for the Star Trek lovers, if you would have a recommended place for them to launch into the world of Lord of the Rings, and then where can they find you and your podcast and connect after the show?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for the Captain's Pod listeners, if you have like literally no idea of what Lord of the Rings is, then I'd say go pick up a copy of The Hobbit and start with The Hobbit. It's a really fun tale. You could read it in probably a week, and it's really, really fun. And it will give you just an introduction to Tolkien's writing style and his world. Now, the complex thing about Tolkien is his writing styles are so varied. And after you pick up The Hobbit, go pick up Lord of the Rings, and you'll start to feel like this story is heavier. This story is deeper. This story is more complex. And Tolkien's writing style will reflect that. But I'd say start with The Hobbit. Go start reading Lord of the Rings. If you haven't seen the Peter Jackson movies, then do not watch The Hobbit movies for Peter Jackson. Go watch the Lord of the Rings movies that Peter Jackson did. If that is your first introduction to Tolkien, then that's a good foundation, a good springboard. And then if you want to go deeper and you're trying to read some Tolkien works and you're just like, man, I can't get this. It's too hard. It's too dense, whatever. Then come over to the Lore of the Rings podcast. I sort of look at myself as 15-minute audio companion, reading companion guides when you're trying to take on Tolkien and you just need a short, like brief, like, hey, here's what's going on. Here's some of the themes you need to look out for. Here's some of the motivations that Tolkien had. That's really what I focus on right now. As of this recording, I have just started going through the Fellowship of the Ring. I'm taking it like 5 pages at a time. So this is going to take me like 5 years to get through the whole Lord of the Rings book.
That's amazing.
It's so like, I thought, 5 pages. At first I thought I could do 10 pages, but I just started digging in. I was like, oh, there's so much on every single page, that we're just going 5 pages at a time, a nice slow read through the Lord of the Rings. And so, if you've never tried it before, you've seen the movies and you haven't read it before, then pick up Lord of the Rings, start reading it, and then come over to Lore of the Rings and get a little bit of a reading companion audio guide to go along with you.
And that's L-O-R-E of the Rings.
Yes, Lore of the Rings. Yeah, and I always, like I said before, we love to wander Middle Earth. We wander the world and works of J.R.R. Tolkien.
I'm
so
excited.
Come wander. Come wander with me.
I want to pick it up where you're starting because I am long overdue for a reread. So I will be joining you. You'll be in my earbuds as I read.
Yeah, fantastic.
Ian, what about you for the Lord of the Rings readers and the Lord of the Rings listeners? Where would you have them start in the Star Trek world? And then where can they find you?
This is the most intimidating and the most commonly asked question of a Star Trek quote-unquote expert and somebody that's like wanting to get into Star Trek. It's so tricky because it's daunting as a first-timer, somebody that hasn't watched anything. Like, where do I begin? Do I go all the way back to 1966 and watch the original series, which has its challenges of being in the 60s? But do I want to start later on where I might miss some context? So where I've landed at the minute, we're in a really lucky time for Star Trek, with Strange New Worlds being on streaming on Paramount Plus. And I honestly think it's an incredible, near perfect place for anybody to be introduced to the franchise, because yes, it's technically a prequel series, but I haven't heard anybody once feel punished by not having Star Trek knowledge going in, but you can be rewarded if you kind of culturally know some things as well. It gives you a great introduction to some long-standing characters. And just in and of itself, that first season in particular is just some incredible sci-fi television. And I think that will give you a really good indicator if Star Trek in general is for you, whether you're a fantasy person or a sci-fi person. I think it'll give you a really good indicator if it's for you or not. And there is an excellent episode in particular called Elysium, yeah, which is
Elysium Kingdom, I think.
Elysium Kingdom, that's it, where they kind of get sucked into a book, essentially. And it's
very Lord of the Rings-esque. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a good
very
one.
Very Lord of the Rings.
Great episode, yeah.
There are wizards and such. But I would recommend starting at season one, episode one, and going through that. And I think that's a really great launching point. If you then want to get deeper into Star Trek, just go back to The Next Generation. I think that's an excellent place to start. That's where Star Trek really found its lore and its kind of like big book of Star Trek and the quote unquote tropes that you know from Star Trek. So many of them came from The Next Generation. So yeah, I think that's a great launching
specifically
point.
With the episode Cause and Effect, which is a super fun episode.
It's especially if you're into time travel shenanigans, an outstanding episode.
We just watched it, so we're kind of obsessed at the minute.
Oh, that's awesome.
The best way to find us, yeah, come and listen. We kind of take an episode at a time. We are a bit sporadic. Our theme at the minute is to talk about whatever Star Trek is on TV. So we've covered the first two seasons of Strange New Worlds. So you can search in the Captain's Pod podcast feed, and as you're watching an episode of Strange New Worlds, come and hear what we thought about it. And then feel free to like kind of just pick the episodes that we've covered. And the great thing about The Next Generation and a lot of Star Trek is that each episode is a self-contained thing. So we'll try and explain a bit of the background and do our nitpicky stuff afterwards as well. So we will happily be your companion through whatever Star Trek you're watching.
And that's Captain's Pod. And just as a quick note, we are on the Captain's Pod side of things, more of an adult themed show. So definitely for those who don't mind some cursy words and some adult themes. So just kind of keep that in mind. And thank you again for coming together, both of you. This has been super, super fun. You can find all of the information that you want in the show notes. And we appreciate you guys doing this like kind of unique episode in your podcast feed. And we look forward to your feedback and have a great day. Bye, podcast listeners.
Thanks for listening. You guys are the best.
Thanks for wandering Middle Earth and Star Trek today. My friends, if you enjoyed this episode, let me know by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing with your friends. Follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Lore of the Rings Podcast. For feedback on the show, please email me using the link in the show notes. Until next Thursday, remember, not all those who wander are lost.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.